Welcome to Animal Voices, airing live on unceded Coast Salish territories here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver's Co-op Radio. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only animal advocacy radio program, bringing you all you need to keep you up to date on what's happening locally and abroad. From interviews with amazing changemakers around the world to news, events, and lifestyle. Animal Voices can be heard live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. PST and streamed from cooperadio.org. After broadcasting, you can check out animalvoices.org for all our past podcasts and more information. My name is Jackie. Joining me in studio today, we have Alyssa.
Hello.
Amir.
Hey.
And Allison.
Hi there.
Today is January 16th, 2015. Today we'll cover an important topic that Animal Voices hasn't touched on in the past, the ways in which the prison abolition movement and animal liberation are connected. We will speak with Sue Brown, an anti-prison and animal liberation activist, about this important issue. We also discuss the ways in which the prison industrial complex hurts activists and ways that it can, in fact, hurt animals, as well as discuss some of the alternatives or potential alternatives to this harmful and oppressive system. But first, last weekend was definitely one to remember if you're an animal activist in our community. On Saturday, 50 activists infiltrated and demonstrated within and outside Whole Foods, spreading the message that there is no way to humanely kill someone that doesn't want to die. This was the largest demonstrations of its kind, as far as I'm aware, in the Vancouver area. This demonstration is following an investigation by Direct Action Everywhere activists into a certified humane facility where hens were covered in their own feces, unable to move freely or at all, and just blatantly suffering. Today we'll chat about our experiences at that demonstration as well as why target Whole Foods.
Excuse me! Now have your attention, please. There's something very disturbing happening at Whole Foods today. They say they love animals. They say they're treating them humanely. But they're lying. They're hiding extreme violence against animals.
She was found at the age of only 2, lying in her own feces. She was severely dehydrated and on the brink of starvation. She was too weak to move. She could not even lift her head. May was found on a humane farm. A humane farm that supplies cage-free eggs to Whole Foods.
Individuals like these are being deprived of basic needs throughout their enslavement.
Luckily, both these girls were rescued by some dedicated activists who nursed them back to health from the brink of death. They are now living in a safe place where they can be happy, healthy, and live free of exploitation and live out the rest of their lives in safety. We are here today to share their story because their lives matter.
There is nothing humane about slaughter. There is nothing compassionate about captivity. And there is nothing ethical about animal agriculture.
We are here today to expose the lies that Whole Foods is selling. They claim to sell meat and dairy and eggs that come from humane farms where animals roam safe and happy. But that could not be further from the truth. And the reality is that animal agriculture is inherently cruel. There is no such thing as humane eggs or humane milk or meat because killing and exploitation is violent. There is no right way to do a wrong thing.
All your money, all your life.
We will never compromise.
All your trophy, all your life.
We will never
So we're hearing a clip from Vancouver on Saturday, January 10th at the Whole Foods on Cambie Street. And it came on, well, actually the demo was one of 50 happening internationally on that same weekend, protesting mostly at Whole Foods against the idea that animals can be killed humanely. The demonstrations come on the heels of disturbing footage that was released from an egg production facility The footage showed hens in deplorable conditions, and it was from a certified humane facility in California, one of the largest egg suppliers for the Whole Foods Corporation. Mainstream news outlets like the New York Times, CBC, and Huffington Post reported on the footage, which was produced by an animal rights network known as Direct Action Everywhere, or DXE. And as Jackie said before, the video showed hens in a really crowded barn with only about a foot of space each, in extreme distress, their beaks cut, their feathers covered in feces. And the Direct Action Everywhere activists involved in the expose, in the movie, they're shown cradling one bird who had been lying in her own feces and not moving. And they performed what is known as an open rescue. The activists took the bird to safety with the camera rolling, not hiding their identity, just to show the world what's happening and get attention to this issue. And the hen that they brought to emergency vet care in the days and weeks following, she has come back to health and vitality. And it's quite a lovely a success story there. So, Direct Action Everywhere, as I said, is a network of activists around the world who practice public speakouts and public demonstrations targeting the humane myth. Their focus over the last couple years or year or so has been Chipotle, which is the fastest growing fast food company in the U.S., not so big in Canada. But as this video came out, they announced their new target, which is Whole Foods Corporation. Mm-hmm. And last Saturday, Jackie, you and I attended that demo in Vancouver. I think I get shivers just listening to the footage again. It was pretty powerful.
It was a really memorable action because you get groups like that large and larger for aquarium demonstrations, rodeos sometimes, those kind of things. So it's very unusual to get that kind of a crowd to come out to this kind of a demonstration. I think that it was really powerful. You could feel the energy in the room. I feel that the large crowd made people, like passerbys, take more notice and actually listen to our message rather than just dismiss us as a few, you know, rare people that care about this. They took it a little bit more seriously, I think, and watched us more. And we even got applause from a woman and her daughter, which was amazing.
Yeah, there's definitely power in numbers. I think you had said before it was about 50 people who attended the Whole Foods in Vancouver on that day, joining many more. The demo in San Francisco had 100 people. Wow. It's like basically everyone in the store turned out to be an activist who had a sign in their jacket and pulled it out. So yeah, that's what it is. We all kind of walked in acting like customers, and the people started speaking out, and then all the supporting activists pulled signs that said, "It's not food, it's violence," from inside their jackets. And it really showed, like, normal customers, unsuspecting, looking around, being like, "Oh, wait, these people are just like me, and they're seeing something. What is this about?" So the video footage is really strong. You could probably,
it's on our website. Yeah.
Oh yeah. On Animal Voices, website, there's the video. The Province did a great video about the demo. So did CBC. Really great coverage and really exciting that people are talking about this. The main question is, why Whole Foods? They sell lots of vegan products. They're super vegan friendly. And, you know, most of us have shopped there, if not regularly shop there. So why are we targeting Whole Foods?
You're asking.
Jackie.
It's not a boycott campaign, so people can still shop there. It's just a really good platform because Whole Foods has this message that the animals they kill or the animals' products that they use are the most humane possible. They even have a 5-step welfare program, they call it. So it's just basically using people that, like, you know, reaching to the people that already care about animals and just saying, hey, there's no way to humanely do this horrible thing, essentially.
Yeah, and it is one of the biggest, I think it's the second biggest grocery chain in North America. I think even bigger than Safeway. It's a massive billion-dollar corporation, and they are really promoting their lie that they care for animals. They have animal compassion signs right over their meat department, and they say the animals are raised with care. But of course, you know, we know that's not true. If you dig a little bit deeper, what does certified humane mean? What does organic mean? What does cage-free mean? mean, they're just labels. They mean like little tiny differences, but in the end, they all end up at the slaughterhouse, their throats slit for no reason other than our pleasure and habit. And we really feel, and Direct Action Everywhere, and I'm an activist with them, we feel, and we know that people will understand the message that, you know, you can't kill an animal humanely, and we can't profit off of people's concern for animals, and we see through their lie. So we'll be talking about in the events just after this about a couple Direct Action Everywhere events coming up, and so that people can get involved. We need to keep growing.
Yep.
And lots of people out, and it was their first time at a demo ever, and that was really amazing.
Talking to those people, yeah.
Like how did they end up there? Well, they know something is wrong. So
everyone listening to Animal Voices, come to the next demo.
Yes.
Take a stand, I got my sisters rolling with me, got my soldiers standing with me, got that kale all in my kidney. All these drugs you keep on using, it's your body that you're losing. Take it back is the solution, it's the kale revolution.
Kale revolution, kale revolution,
yeah.
Kale revolution,
what?
Kale revolution,
it's
time to take a stand, yeah, part of the solution. Kale revolution,
what?
Kale revolution,
eat my greens, eat them up. If I love them, yup, love them raw, love them all, that's all I keep telling y'all. Love them chips, healthy chips, vitamins, we super rich. I'ma keep on puffing it, healthier with benefits.
Kale revolution, kale revolution,
yeah.
Kale revolution,
what?
Kale revolution, it's time to take a stand, yeah, part of the solution. Kale revolution,
what?
Kale revolution,
I can make kale plain. Barbecue a hot, that's a small thing. I can make a lot of them. Gonna sell the kale by the metric ton. Yeah, I love that healthy stuff. Yeah, I say no to your drugs. Yeah, my body full of love. Get it straight from God above. Healthy keep me running right. Vitamins be out of sight. Bringing duck into the light.
Kale revolution. Kale revolution.
Now we're here. Started from the garden, now the kale revolution here. Started from the garden, now we're here. Started from the pot into the salad, now the chips are here. I'ma eat the salad up. Got some water in my cup. Eating green and healthy stuff. Crunchy, I can't get enough. I'ma keep my body right. Yeah, cause I be eating right. Kale, I like them jugo plain. Healthy, live without the pain.
Kale revolution. Kale revolution.
In my cheek, you ain't know it. Got kale on your teeth, you ain't know it. Got kale on your hair, you ain't know it. Got kale on your hair, you ain't know it. Eat that kale up, eat it mean. Eat that kale up, cause it's green. Gotta make you wanna wonder.
So that was Kale Revolution by Watoto from the Nile, and yeah, it's a great song, and I think it kind of ties into our revolutionary show we have today.
You are listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's co-op radio. We are broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. Now, just quickly, a few events coming up around this land. First of all, we have our annual collaboration with Drishti Point Yoga Radio. We're trying to, you know, build connections in the community, and this is one of our important collabs. So what we're producing is a Valentine's Day weekend of events. We call it Love in Action. What does it look like to put our love in action and act in the world? How can we ensure activism is rooted in love and compassion for all? How can we regenerate our spirit and become warriors of the light? So Thursday, February 12th, we're going to kick off the weekend with
the bake sale, vegan bake sale. So that's going to be shared proceeds going towards Hearts on Noses, Animal Voices, as well as Drishy Point, and the rest of our events, which we'll talk about later. So we are still looking for bakers. If you want to sign up to bake, just look for information on the Facebook page, which is called Valentine's Day Bake Sale, I believe. It's kind of vague, but it's under Animal Voices if you look at our Facebook page. And it's going to be amazing. There's going to be some great baked goods, and it's all going to a great cause.
And Friday, February 13th, we are featuring the Vancouver premiere of Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist. If you like Whale Wars or what was the other one? Eco-Pirate. It's another great documentary about Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. We're really excited to be screening that. We're most likely, almost definitely going to have one of the filmmakers there for a Q&A after. Oh. And I think we'll be offering like some treats and tea and stuff after, and info tables and books for sale. And it's going to be a really fun event, so that it's at SFU downtown. So just mark the date for now. Check out our website for details, or just
drishtipoint.ca is where all the details are at.
Yeah, drishtipoint. So drishtipoint, you can Google and then just search Love in Action. So we're really excited about that film screening. And then on Valentine's Day itself, Saturday, February 14th, if you're sick of the consumerism and, you know, all the couple stuff and all the red and pink and blah, blah, blah. If that stuff gives you a sick feeling in your stomach like it does for me, then why don't you join us for a yoga workshop on Valentine's Day, Saturday, February 14th in the afternoon. It's about love in action. So we're just kind of merging yoga and veganism and activism. And there's a lot there to talk about. And I went to the workshop last year that was hosted by Farah and Cynthia, and it was really amazing.
I think too, even if you are in a couple and you want to celebrate Valentine's Day with your partner, that would be a lovely way to do it, is bring your partner. So even if you hate V-Day, if you love it, come.
Yeah.
That's the message.
The events we're hosting aren't so much about romance, but they're about love in the bigger, broader sense. Do we have time for one more?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's a group in Vancouver based on Coast Salish territories here called Cafe Rebelda. And I've been getting involved with them a little bit. And they try to really make links between the environmental devastation of mining projects in South America, particularly. But they're also drawing a lot of connections between Indigenous resistance here and violence against women. And I always find their events really illuminating. And their next one is on Monday, January 26th. At Grandview Calvary Church on First Ave in the evening. Starts at 6 p.m. It is called Connecting the Dots, Ayotzinapa and the Violence Against Women. It's drawing links between the 43 students that were murdered in Mexico in September and between Indigenous resistance here. And the feature speaker is going to be Kanahus of the Sequipmuc Woman Warrior Society. And so it'll be short film speakers, and they are hosting a free vegan dinner as well. Proceeds of this event go towards buying a community radio for the students and parents in the Ayotzinapa region. So check that out, Connecting the Dots.
Thanks, Alyssa. So now we're going to go into our feature interview with Sue Brown. Sue Brown is an anti-prison vegan and animal liberation activist. She is an anarcho-feminist, which led her to expand her political beliefs. Sue has hosted a variety of film screenings and talks related to prison abolition and believes in a more intersectional approach to animal activism. Hi, Sue, and thanks for joining us on Animal Voices.
Hi.
Hi. So to start off, what kind of work do you do to help prisoners, and how has this impacted you?
So I do a bunch of different kinds of work, I guess. My day job, I do advocacy for people who are in prison. So that's, I guess, just focuses on helping prisoners with day-to-day problems that they experience while they're in custody, as well as trying to get out of custody. And in addition to that, in my personal life, I work on a couple of projects. The one that I'm doing currently is called the Cake and File Collective, and we're an anti-prison collective aimed at sort of public education, awareness raising around prisons and conditions in prison and conditions of confinement, and generally trying to advance an anti-prison analysis locally here in Vancouver. And we're trying to network nationally with other collectives to sort of build a bigger, stronger movement in Canada against prisons.
Well, that's great. And why did you first decide to get involved in prison abolition?
That's a good question. It kind of, I think, probably necessitates a pretty long answer.
That's okay.
So I guess I've always been kind of drawn to it. From a young age, I can remember sort of just being really appalled at the stories that I'd heard, both in the media and anecdotally, about conditions and treatment of people in prison. And I just sort of always felt, for obvious reasons, that it was wrong, and kind of saw a lot of it as an abuse of power, because, you know, growing up you're told that that prisons and police are there to protect you. And I myself identify as a white woman, so I have a lot of relative privilege. I have to acknowledge that right off the bat. And so my experiences with the police and prisons were not as awful. Obviously, I didn't have any experience with prisons, but even my experiences with the police growing up weren't what they are for many people who come from sort of racialized backgrounds, poverty, having experienced the brunt of colonization and things like that. But I still saw problems with the idea that anybody could kind of be subjected to any kind of brutality, especially by institutions that we're told are supposed to be protecting people. So, and I didn't like the idea of people being placed in vulnerable places like prisons, where all of their liberties are taken away from them, and that they wouldn't have anything to sort of protect themselves. So, I mean, that was just kind of inherent. And then as I got older, I started developing more of a critical analysis of the state and about prisons, and started seeing the connections between prisons and sort of the entire criminal justice apparatus, actually, and poverty, racism, colonialism, patriarchy, violence. And then I really began to start questioning the legitimacy of prisons, of state institutions generally, and the role that they play in terms of maintaining larger systemic inequalities and injustices, and have sort of now kind of come to the conclusion that they constitute a form of state-sponsored violence, really, and that they're capitalist, colonialist, patriarchal institutions designed to enforce compliance norms and expectations that a lot of people simply can't abide to by. And, you know, and then on the flip side as well, I mean, in terms of, you know, even moving away from that critical analysis, just the material conditions in Canadian prisons might be better than other places in the world, but they're not good. And some of the real injustices lie in sort of the Kafkaesque bureaucratic nature of the system, and the fact that by their very design, I think they really ruin people's lives. There's nothing about prisons in Canada or elsewhere that really help people or fix people, as far as I can tell. And I truly believe that that people leave prisons more traumatized and disheartened and mistrustful than when they went in. It really breaks people down. And I think that people leave, if they weren't dangerous going in, and then I think people do have to question sort of their assumptions about who people are in prison and where they come from and why they're there. But if they weren't dangerous going in, I can certainly say that many of them are probably more dangerous coming out after experiencing what they do.
Yeah, and when you were talking about, you know, the capitalism and all the connections, that kind of leads me into my next question.
Okay.
Just for listeners that may not know, can you tell us about the prison industrial complex and what this term means?
Yeah. So the term generally plays on sort of an older term, which you probably heard, which is the military industrial complex, which is a term that was sort of developed to understand that war was much more than simply battles between countries over various issues or pieces of land or et cetera, right? But that there's an entire industry around the war and military that people benefit from. So, you know, I think pretty common knowledge people can see that war is considered to be an economic driver. because there's so many industries that benefit from it. It's the same, so this, that same concept was applied to prisons. So the term the prison industrial complex generally is used to emphasize the fact that prisons are much more than just institutions for warehousing or reforming quote-unquote bad people. But there's an implication there that there's an economic imperative and perhaps a political imperative to prisons, whereby there's more than simply being, like, there's more to be gained than simply just keeping criminals off the street or rehabilitating people. But so in that, then, the prison industrial complex sort of represents a set of relationships or a number of players who are involved in and who actually profit from the prison industry. So there's, you know, infrastructure considerations, for example, like the people who have to build the prisons and the infrastructure, the cells, the maintenance of the prison infrastructure, for example. I think like the telephone systems, like TELUS makes a whole lot of money off of the phone systems and the contract that they have with Corrections Services Canada. The food and where that food comes from, the water services, the labor for staffing the prisons, all of those are considered economic drivers. And so, you know, it's been a huge, it's no secret in the States that the prisons have been used to sort of rebound economically depressed towns. And we see the same thing here. I know there's a prison going in provincially in Oliver. Actually, it's on a First Nations reserve. And it's going there. One of the selling points for it was that it would bring jobs to the area where they're currently experiencing some depression and a super twisted sort of leap of logic. You know, it was actually sold to the First Nation as an opportunity for them to for employment options for people who are on reserve, First Nations people on reserve who don't necessarily have access to labor. So there's there's an economic, it's really an industry where people are benefiting. It's, you know, politicians benefit by boosting the economies in areas that they feel are depressed. It looks good to build prisons because politicians can sort of benefit from advancing tough on crime rhetoric and advancing tough on crime policies. And then you have sort of these tertiary levels of or people who benefit or industries that benefit, which include the media, who benefits from, you know, sexy crime stories and stuff like that. And the idea, you know, they make a lot of money off of crime, if it leads, it leads type stories. Politicians, investors in various products required to make prisons. So it goes on and on and on. But there's an entire industry supporting it. And the idea and the importance of that term is that that prisons, the purpose of prisons, we have to be questioning whether it's in fact to, you know, keep our streets safer, as we're told, and to rehabilitate people, or is there actually sort of a broader economic or political motive to prisons. And I think that many of us who hold a critical view of prisons and who see and believe that they aren't actually doing what we're being told they're doing, and that they're not rehabilitating people, they're not helping people, and they're certainly not reducing crime, then what is the purpose? And I think that the economic and political benefits have, you know, a role in why prisons continue to be built and why Stephen Harper is pushing a tough on crime agenda, despite what research says, despite what the experiences have been in the U.S., and so on and so forth. So that's sort of where the term comes from.
So much.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you kind of, you know, built on, you described a few of the things that I could see being connected earlier, but from prison abolition, what led you into veganism and animal liberation?
That's a good question. I don't know that I necessarily came, like, one didn't necessarily precede the other in any kind of logical, I mean, they did chronologically, but I don't know, and I'm sure my beliefs, and I think I was talking earlier about sort of developing a critical analysis around prisons and really starting to see, develop like an anti-capitalist, feminist analysis of the world generally, and something that became very important to me and very apparent to me. Was that the animal exploitation industries, like I guess, you know, prisons and so many other forms of oppression, is entirely oppressive and is entirely part of this broader system of oppressions and harms that are being perpetrated for the benefit of a very few people, or for the benefit of maintaining a system, an economy, a capitalist system. and a colonialist system. So I guess I've just sort of, I was vegetarian, and certainly, you know, from a young age have had an awareness of generally like animal welfare and concern for animals. I love animals, and they've always been a part of my life. And then sort of as I became more aware and developed more of an understanding about the harms of all of those animal industries, it made me really angry in the same way that prisons make me really angry, to hear about the suffering and the exploitation for little benefit and for no apparent reason, for the most part, except that people want to make money off of it. And so that's sort of what led me there. And I guess there's other connections too, like in terms of I guess we can get into a little bit later maybe, but just in terms of the way that animals are conceptualized, it's very similar to the way that criminals are conceptualized, and it's done so in ways that allow us to feel okay about the idea that they suffer, or that harm can be meted out against them for some benefit.
And, we were just talking about like your the connection between animal liberation. Since many animal rights groups tend to, you know, celebrate convictions against animal abusers, can you tell me some of the problems with this reinforcement of the oppressive system?
Yeah, absolutely. generally, I think. First of all, it doesn't actually criminalizing people who commit harm against animals doesn't, I think, actually address the problem. More often than not, the focus seems to fall on individuals who have committed heinous acts against animals. It's awful. I hate hearing those stories. Say, like some of the exposés around slaughterhouse workers, for example, or dairy farm workers and stuff. And it's horrible to hear the stories, but they themselves are, we have to recognize, coming from places. The majority of people who work in slaughterhouses and on dairy farms and in those environments also come from hugely politicized and often forms of oppression. They come from poverty. A lot of migrant workers work in slaughterhouses. A lot of prisoners and ex-prisoners work in slaughterhouses. And on dairy farms, they're hugely marginalized themselves. And so if we sort of factor in a broader analysis of both prisons and animal liberation that sees the connections between poverty and capitalism, patriarchy, colonialism, and then we see that it's much bigger than simply holding individual people accountable for the heinous acts that they commit against individuals, non-human or human. It's about actually holding the system accountable, and it's about actually dismantling a system that is inherently violent and that perpetuates violence. And so relying on another arm of that system to deal with the abuses in one area isn't ever going to fix the problem. And criminalizing individual people who come from racialized backgrounds, backgrounds of poverty, much like most of the people who are in prison, and this is where, of course, we have to have a really, understand that the majority of people who are in prison come from histories of having experienced a lot of violence, as children growing up. Many of them were in the foster care system. There's a disproportionate representation of people of color in prison and Aboriginal people in prison. A hugely disproportionate number of people who have mental health problems, other forms of disability, lack of education. So many examples of the way that people in prison are so oppressed, and that prisons themselves represent a place for warehousing oppressed people, and that prisons themselves are oppressive. It's harmful to suggest that that is ever going to be a solution, that the prisons where people are subject to violence, subject to losing their liberty, or the criminal justice system generally, which seeks to sort of keep people down, is ever going to solve the individual issues that those people had in perpetuating the harms that they may have against those animals. That logically doesn't make sense. And moreover, relying on, like I said, one arm of the system to deal with the problems of another arm of the system is just like a snake eating its tail. It's just never going to actually address the issue. We really have to address capitalism, colonialism, mm-hmm. poverty, speciesism, and come to a bigger understanding of that. Does that...
Yeah, that's a great answer. And I think it kind of, you know, touches on the fact that, like, a lot of people have this, still have this, like, eye for an eye mentality. And mm-hmm. When you're putting, you know, a human in a cage, you're not actually taking an animal out of a cage. Mm-hmm. You're just kind of reinforcing this oppressive system and this oppressive mentality.
Exactly. And also just to add on to that as well, is that, like, when we're focusing on the individuals, we're not actually, like, as much as I, like, this might contradict what I just said, we should be also looking, if we're going to start holding people accountable, we shouldn't be looking to the slaughterhouse workers.
Mm-hmm,
we shouldn't be
absolutely.
Looking to those people. We should be looking at the CEOs and the people in positions of power who are truly dangerous and who are truly inflicting all of this harm if we want to get down to it. And we want to put someone in prison, those are the people probably be targeting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And how does the prison system negatively impact activists, particularly mm-hmm. animal liberation activists?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, generally speaking, it's an institution of social control. It's part of a larger system that socially controls people using various levels of sort of repression and retaliation. A number of activists don't actually ever go to prison, but the threat of prison itself is always there and is something that can sort of just generally cause people to modify their behaviors or change the way they do things or decide not to do things a certain way. So it stifles activism, which is really important. For activists who actually do get caught up in the criminal justice system, it can destroy their lives. It can paralyze any activism that they're engaged in. So it can really hinder and serve to stop people from making any political advancements or for even speaking out sometimes about issues that they care about. I mean, it's particularly bad in the U.S., and I think it's certainly headed that way here in Canada, that, you know, like, activists can be criminalized for otherwise, like, quite trivial actions. I mean, when we think about it, prisons, in theory, are supposed to be the last resort for dealing with, transgressions of social norms and values, and otherwise known as crime, I guess. so the idea that activists are going to prison in the U.S. for sending emails, for example, mm-hmm. or for having tools in the back of their car or something like that is really quite egregious when you think about it. I mean, it's really clear that, especially in the U.S., that there's a campaign targeting animal rights activists. I mean, that obviously they've been sort of labeled as extremists and terrorists and have faced some of the most extreme prison sentences that I'm aware of for people engaged in any kind of, politically conscious activities. So it's the prison and the threat of prison will stifle activism, and that it can really do a huge amount of damage to people who end up there. And then it also serves politically as a tool for completely dismantling movements. And when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about the American Legislative Exchange Council. So just bear with me for a second. But basically, like, if we think again and think of it more largely in terms of the prison industrial complex, and when we're talking about all of the connections between the animal exploitation industries, the prison industrial complex, and things like that, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is a really good example of how all of the political interests involved in both come together and use prisons and use laws to repress activists in order to advance political goals. And ALEC is basically a conglomerate of, it's a council, it's an association of corporate CEO types from all of the major corporations in the U.S. and transnational corporations internationally who come together and both write and then lobby to have certain policies pushed and to basically bring them to government and say, you need to pass this piece of legislation. So it's no surprise to anybody that a lot of politicians are in bed with and certainly have a lot of connections with people who are CEOs or on boards of these major corporations. But they're also friends with people who are on ALEC. And when ALEC is writing up this legislation, they're writing up this legislation with corporate interests in mind. So a good example of a piece of legislation that they wrote up was the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act in the U.S. That piece of legislation was written by members of corporations with the express intent of criminalizing activists so that they could continue doing what they were doing and without the threat of sort of retaliation or resistance from the community. So that's kind of one example that comes to mind.
Great. My next question might be, go into quite a lot of detail, but I'm just curious, what are some, just a few alternatives to using police and prisons that you are in support of?
Okay, so there's no short answer to that question.
Yeah.
I'll try and summarize it as briefly as I can. but basically, restorative justice is a term, it's a buzzword, and I would certainly suggest that it needs to be unpacked and, really, really considered. But there's a lot of ideas that come from restorative justice that are very useful. Really, what we need to do is we need to stop relying on police, we need to stop relying on prisons to solve the problems in our communities. We need to look towards more community-oriented models of responding, so accountability circles and processes in smaller communities are really like that is sort of the be all and end all of what I think would be a good system. Having said that, it's very hard to imagine a world without prisons because they're so embedded into the way our entire system is structured, our entire everything, right? Like in terms of, so I mean, we have a lot to dismantle before we can ever even start to think about what those alternatives look like. On the flip side, though, we should start considering what those alternatives are now. And so building stronger communities where we're able to talk about these issues and work out these issues without relying on the police, without, relying on these formal systems, that's the way to go. And I guess I know we're probably pressed for time. Is that true?
That's true. Yeah, we have a few minutes left.
Okay. So, because I was just going to say I would leave with something that, like, a quote from Angela Davis, actually, which is, it's not quite a quote, but an idea from Angela Davis, in that whenever she's asked this question, it's important to realize that we shouldn't be looking for an alternative or a solution that fits the footprint of what prisons are, because no other institution is ever going to, like, do any better than what the prisons are doing right now. We can't be looking for just something to put in its place. We have to reimagine the world that we live in. And I guess the ways that we can start sort of doing that now is to start looking at, like, reallocating our resources and looking at what the roots of criminalization and crime are and who is in prison and why they're there. And we can see that the problems lie in our failures of our education system. The fact that, we have endemic poverty, the roots of colonization and all of the traumas associated with all of those. The fact that, like, some 70% of people who are in prison came from the foster care system is an appalling statistic. So we need to be looking at the all of the failures in all of those sort of social welfare type institutions and start building that up, putting more attention towards how do we create healthier people and healthier communities so that prisons, we don't need to replace prisons, we don't need prisons in the first place. We have strong communities and strong families and strong qualities of lives. And that, of course, requires reimagination of more than just, that it requires, tearing down the system and rebuilding the whole thing.
Mm-hmm, like an entire culture change,
yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, so there's no short answer.
It's okay.
No answer.
There's a lot of great information.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, finally, how can animal activists show solidarity to the prison abolition movement?
So I guess most importantly would be, I guess, to stop in terms of the rhetoric. It would be helpful if there was less of an emphasis on criminalizing people who cause harm to animals and sort of a broader focus on what the problems are with the system and developing a broader analysis of, and not to say they don't, this sounds kind of condescending and I'm not trying to, but just generally speaking, the moving away from a rhetoric or language that promotes criminalizing people or using state and police as a response to harm against animals and focusing more on dismantling those industries and drawing connections between those industries and other systems of oppression, I would say, is probably the most important piece. I think generally what I think everybody can do, not just animal rights activists, but everyone.
Great. And also, thank you so much for joining us today, Sue. It was a great interview, so much information.
Cool.
Hopefully a lot of activists are going to listen to this and share the information with everyone they know.
Cool. And thank you so much for doing this. I really enjoyed the interview.
Yeah, it was great.
I'm really glad.
Thanks, Sue.
We talked about it. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. So on January 24th, Sue will also be hosting a talk with a DXE activist, Direct Action Everywhere activists, locally, and it's called... It's a Facebook event called Staring Down the State, Rights, Surveillance, and Security Culture. I recommend everyone check that event out.
Roots Reggae, heard every Friday night from midnight until daylight. 7 hours long and 7 hours strong. Giving you music for the mind, soul, and body. It's an holistic experience. We say it's ITIL and VITIL. My name is Lyndon V, and you've got it locked in Vancouver's Healing Station, 100.5 FM CFRO.
You're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 CFRO, Vancouver's co-op radio. Just a few little news clips for you before we finish off the show. First of all, Sue Brown happens to work with the Wildlife Defense League. That wasn't mentioned in the interview, but they have a new campaign that they're launching soon to fight trophy hunting in BC. Check out their website, Wildlife Defense League. And in bear news, according to a new investigative report, wild bears in BC are under attack by trophy hunters. Their populations are being eradicated in certain areas, according to locals. The recent report focused specifically on the Pitt River Valley, which is about an hour east of Vancouver. People who've lived and worked in that area for years have been used to seeing black bears almost daily, but last year they barely saw any at all. The report lays the blame on one single trophy hunting guide based in Kamloops. His name is Abe Dugan. He runs Big Boar Outfitters, and over the last 10 years, Dugan and his clients have killed approximately 350 black bears in BC, a large number from a small area in the Pitt River watershed. The Ministry of Forest, Lands, and Natural Resources insists the bear hunt is well managed, and a ministry spokesperson says black bears aren't at risk in the Pitt River area or anywhere else. Notably, Abe Dugan is facing 12 criminal charges in BC for violations of the Wildlife Act that date back to 1999, and he's also banned from hunting in the Yukon for hunting violations there. The BC government says that what Dugan is doing now is perfectly legal. In BC, there are no requirements to report the killing of a black bear or any details about the bear or location of the kill, because apparently their numbers are just fine. And another couple very quick things. Chipotle has pulled pork or dead pig bodies from the menu after animal welfare violation. The Mexican food chain's problem, they have a problem with one of their suppliers' treatment of pigs, and they have pulled carnitas off their menu, which I'm seeing basically as a marketing ploy. They're trying to get people to trust that their products are animal friendly. And finally, animal rights group In Defense of Animal puts the Edmonton Valley Zoo in their Hall of Shame. The Edmonton Valley Zoo has been on that group's top 10 list of worst zoos 4 times. It's second last year. It's in their Hall of Shame because of Lucy the elephant. Elephants from Africa should not be in cold Canadian weather. And obviously, there's groups calling for her to be moved. And that's it for the news today.
Thank you for that, Alyssa. You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us on next week's show on Friday, January 23rd. What do we have coming up for next week, Alyssa?
That's a really great question. Maybe when Alyssa scores a guest, she will, it'll be a surprise. Yeah, I don't know. I'm working on it.
Well, I will definitely tune in for a surprise.
I'm trying to get Joanna Macy, but I'm not sure. She's a Buddhist scholar, and she's into systems theory and deep ecology, and she has a new book called Coming Back to Life, and it's all about activism and making change, and she's a vegan as well and an outstanding woman. I'm trying to get her, so crossing my fingers.
Well, that's certainly enough of a teaser to get me to want to tune in. So please join us on the web as well. You can join us on Facebook, as we've mentioned on the show today. Our Facebook page is at Animal Voices Vancouver. We're also on Twitter, Animal Voices YVR, or you can send us a note to let us know how we're doing at our email address at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. What's the song that we have coming up, Jackie?
Yeah, so we're going to be leaving today with a song called It Pulls Me Under by Butterfly Boucher. It's not specifically about animal rights, but it talks a lot about kind of the out of control states of the world and just feeling repressed. So I think it ties into our show about prisoners and also a lot of what we can feel as activists at times.
Coming up next is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith, and please remember to tune in next week, and especially remember to be kind to the animals.